From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another edition of the Midnight Movie Cowboys. My name is Hunter Deucing down in Dallas, Texas. And joining me out in the wild outback of Australia, we have Mr. Stuart Balk. Say hello, Stu.
Hello, Stu.
And up in the Rocky Mountain High of Colorado, we have Mr. John Grace. Say hello, John.
Hello.
And joining us today, sometimes on the Midnight Movie Cowboys, we like to highlight certain talent we like, certain authors we enjoy. And today, we have an author we really enjoy, author of such books as Thriving in Bad Places, The Punching Art, and my favorite title, Win Your Food, A Fighter's View of Predatory Aggression. I love that title. We have Mr. James LaFond. Say hello, James.
Hello. Thank you very much. And I've suffered brain damage, so I got Stu from Australia. I got John Grace. I talked to the other night, and I forgot his name halfway through the conversation. And the nice young man that just talked to me from Texas. What's your name again?
Hunter. I'm Hunter.
Hunter. Okay. All right. I should have remembered that. All right.
Yeah. So, I'm the guy who's not food. You know, if you think of my name that way.
Okay.
I'm the guy eating the food. Maybe not in real life, but just in terms of my name.
Well,
you know?
See, I could be classed as food if it's like an Irish stew, but I'm not Irish. I'm Australian.
Well, yeah, but you're in Australia where you are food because everything's trying to kill you.
Right.
don't joke.
I'm glad you like that title.
yeah. I think, Stu, you need to get that book, When You're Food, because, you know, where you are, it's kind of dangerous.
Yeah, it really is. My son got bitten by a redback spider twice. My 7-year-old.
Gosh.
Had to get an anti-venom. So, yeah, it was not pretty.
Oof.
Yes. But anyway. So he was but food temporarily for the spider.
But, James, you're an author John and I have talked about quite a bit over the past year or so, and John, you had said you were wanting to get him on the show, so I guess I'm going to bounce the ball over to you, sir. Talk a little bit about, because you've been familiar with James longer than I have, so I kind of talk about a little bit about that, and then, you know.
Yeah, pass. And I'm halfway through one of James' recent collections, which is called Letters from Planet Meathead, which is about experiences in boxing and observing MMA contests, martial arts classes, just all sorts of stuff. And I highly recommend it. I'm about, according to Kindle, I'm 70% through it. And it's about, gosh, I think, what is it, James? Like 400 and something pages, 600 pages? It's pretty massive.
It's between 600 and 700 pages. Yeah, it was a long one.
Right. Now, James, to introduce yourself to our listeners, what is sort of your Cliff Notes version of your author bio and what your specialty is?
An unrepentant thought criminal who is currently homeless, living in a garage in Portland, Oregon for the next month. And I write a lot of books that nobody buys. So that's pretty much. I have the dubious distinctions of having been kicked out by three women in the same 24-hour period, having been chased through the streets of Baltimore on four different occasions by pit bulls. So I have other distinctions, but it's kind of an odd list.
But
I was a grocer. I worked at the bottom of the economy and in Baltimore, Maryland, as a grocer for 38 years.
Oh, my.
So I stocked shelves in the hell for 38 years.
Jeez. The world of the wire, basically.
Yeah.
Right. And I worked on night crews, so I had to take the bus to work at night. I worked in 34 different supermarkets total, but I probably spent half of my time in four specific markets. That's basically it. I've had 670 some stick fights. Lost like 171 of them. So, yeah, that hurt. I had 21 ill-conceived boxing matches, 7-5-9. I think that's the record. 7 wins by knockout, 5 losses by, 4 losses by knockout, 1 by decision, and 9 draws. 8 of them would have been losses if they would have been bouts that had referees. But, I just got my ass beat and didn't quit. But I've turned out to be a good boxing coach, and mostly I work with guys that are transitioning to MMA from some art, and they want to work on their hands game. And since I wrestled for a couple years unsuccessfully, I might add, I was a third string wrestler, and the 3 times I wrestled, I never got pinned, but I lasted all 6 minutes of every bout and never scored a point. So I was like a dubious Matt Tard when it came to wrestling. I never had much hits, so it was easy to flip me over. But for some reason, somehow, I managed not to get pinned just because I didn't wrestle enough. So I've done, I guess I've coached a couple hundred people now. Yeah, mostly in the Baltimore, Maryland area, but. Yeah, I haven't really lived there since April last year. So,
what got you out of Baltimore?
Well, in 2010, I decided I saw this. I didn't have a house. I lost my house. I failed to buy a house and had to leave it to the bank so I could get my son a decent school district. And 10 years later, when I was single, I was watching this. Late night TV. It was like a military channel or something like that. I'm watching like the top 10 best tanks. And Robert Wagner had this infomercial about reverse retirement. And it was like you use your house. You put some kind of reverse mortgage on your house and you get money to like live happily ever after until you die. Then when you die, they basically enslave your kids and take all your stuff or something. I don't know what it was. But I looked at that, and
I was like,
you know what? I don't have a house anymore, but I have a job that really sucks. I'm the benign stepfather to 110 criminals and drug addicts where I'm managing a supermarket. So I'm going to do a reverse retirement, but instead of the house, I'm going to cash in a job. So I just quit abruptly the next day, put the organization into a brief crisis, which it soon got over. And I decided to write for a living, which meant I had to work part-time in a supermarket at night as a grunt again, you know, a few nights a week, which got me lots of material because I get attacked on a regular basis going back and forth to work. So it got me lots of self-defense material. And then finally, I got, it was December 7th, I think, of 2017. 2 different pairs of guys tried to mug me on the same night. And
good Lord.
I found myself, and the last 2 dudes could have definitely done it. The first 2 guys, if the black dude hadn't grabbed the white dude and dragged him away from me, I would have went to prison forever, okay, for like ruining their promising college careers, probably. But the then I get on the bus. There's nobody on the bus. It's like Midnight Meat Train or something. It's like some horror movie.
Nice.
And then I get off the bus, and the bus driver's like, "You sure you want to get off here?" I'm like, "Well, I got to walk 1.5 miles to work, so head to work." Don't see anybody. When I started that job 8 years earlier, there'd be 15 people at this bus stop. There's 30 people on the bus. Then I get to the end of Old Eastern Avenue, and I see these 2 big brothers. These guys are like 6'2", 280, mid-30s. They look like twins. They both have empty canvas sacks and heavy coats on. And they're converging on this pretty little brunette that's getting in her SUV, reading her smartphone. I was like, well, shit, I should do something. And I was like, no, I don't think so. But then my heel scraped on the curb, okay? and they saw me, and they looked at me, and then they looked at each other. She still doesn't see him there. She's getting in her SUV now. They both backed up like robots. They got shoulder to shoulder. They walked around Mobilaji's pickup truck. He's a Nigerian guy that runs a 7-Eleven at night. And they walked around the grass and onto the sidewalk and walked towards me shoulder to shoulder. And I actually needed this cane to walk with. I mean, I've fought with canes, and I've had a lot of stick fights. And I mean, I could crack a normal human skull, but these things look like NFL helmets. I mean, I'm looking at this. I was like, okay. Yeah, you know, I definitely give the dude on the right a concussion, and then his brother basically stumps me into pudding. And I probably, if I could get my knife out, I'm probably not going to be able to open it because I broke my right hand's been broken like, I don't know, 7 to 10 times, something like that. So I have a hard time opening a folding knife. So I'm like, okay, this is it. I'm done. And then they stop. Like, 2 paces from me, and that's go time right there. 2 paces is like they're either going to hit you or they're going to back out. And they looked at each other. They didn't even motion with their chins. They just used eye contact. These guys probably been mugging people since they were 5 years old, and they definitely looked like brothers. And they looked at me again, and then they backed up again like two robots, and then shoulder to shoulder they turned as one, and they walked across the street. And I'm like, okay, I'm like the stringy leopard, the last thing left on the Serengeti, and the lions and the hyenas are trying to figure out if I'm tasty enough to maybe get scratched, taking me down. The ecosystem was hunted out. There was nobody left on the street to hunt. Everybody used to take the bus, was spending half their paycheck doing Uber rides back and forth to work. Yeah. So I was like, okay, I told my boss that night, I said, look, you know, I almost didn't make it in here twice. So this is it, you know. I just got to call it quits. This is crazy, you know. To make $130 a week, I basically had to go through that. So, but again, that was a lot of material for me. I think the book with that stuff in it got banned by Amazon. So when that and 3 other books got banned by Amazon for reasons I do not know,
when did they get banned?
Autumn in a Dying City was banned this time last year. It's still available in Kindle. They only banned the print, not the Kindle, and they wouldn't tell me why. The Logic of Steel and The Fighting Edge, who were 2 books that had been alive for 18 years, got banned, and a book called Barbarism versus Civilization got banned in the literary womb. I just loaded it on the back end as a proof. It wasn't even ready to get edited, and they banned it. So I gave those 4 books to my editor, so they're hers. She can publish them and make the money off of them. So she can find some other way of doing it. So my income of $325 a month got slashed down to like $225, and my rent was $200. You know. And I need to lose some weight, but I don't need to lose that much weight. You know, $25 a month. I spend like $20 a week on groceries. $25 a month wasn't going to make it. I was going to have to start having sex with women again or something in order to feed, and that would have been a fear with my writing. So I had a choice. I could like rent a $100 room in the ghetto, so deep into the ghetto that I wouldn't be able to leave my underwear behind when I went out of the house. And then I'd never be able to travel to any of these nice people that wanted me to come and visit them. Or I could just just live out of a backpack and travel around the country. So that's what I'm doing. I decided to do the latter, and it's been good for my writing. So that's what it's about. So that's kind of like, you know, how I ended up in Big Tony's garage. It's a cool spot. I hung up some canvas tarps from the Joyces. I got some dollar store cotton bath mats and put them between the joists so the draft wouldn't come in. There's a crow that lives on top of the crotch and clacks around in the morning, so I sleep too late. The other half of the garage I made into like a little boxing gym, so I coach him and his youngest son.
So have you done a lot of coaching for boxing?
I started in 96. 96? Actually, 94. My first guy went in the ring in 96, and I coached. I was a head coach at a gym briefly in a place called Dundalk, Maryland in 2002 until I got flooded out and we lost all of our equipment. And then I ended up being a visiting coach at 7 different MMA clubs. I would be the boxing coach for 7 different MMA clubs through different periods, and they overlapped, and sometimes it was up to 3 of them at one time. I filled in for a guy named Jimmy at Bainesville Boxing when he was out with an ankle injury for about 10 months and coached his people. And now I just coach people that I visit. There's a guy that used to come at, and there's one guy that used to came to Baltimore for 18 years straight for boxing lessons from me. And I now visit him, and I coach at the dent gym where he trains. And you know, so it's pretty much informal. It's not like I don't charge money or have lessons or something, or, you know, do seminars or anything like that. I had various friends that I knew through boxing that were martial arts guys. I mean, every martial arts they're just got a guy in it to box. And, you know, as guys my age were started to run these places, they're like, hey, you know, why don't you come and show my people how to box? You know, so I would like coach black belts for kickboxing and things like that.
Who's one of your favorite boxers of all time?
Marvin Hagler.
Yeah, good. That's
and we share that. John Grace and I share that. We talked about Marvin Hagler for a while.
And myself. Yeah. He's my favorite as well. He's my favorite of all time ever. He's the best.
Well, he's the most dominant middleweight champion, I think, because of the way he won his fights. He has arguments with other people like Monzon the nut that had one eye and fought 300 fights and had like 70 no decisions, Harry Greb. Yeah, there's arguments for other guys maybe being the top guy, but Hagler went out there and went to war every time.
Yeah.
So he had a tremendous will, and I think that's what a middleweight's supposed to have. To dominate.
What about Roberto Duran? What are your thoughts on him?
He's one of my favorite fighters, and I was rooting for him against Hagler. Roberto Duran is the reason why I started boxing. I spent my whole childhood being beat up, and eventually my big cousin, I was a little kid getting beat up by teenagers and stuff. And eventually my cousin, who was a heavyweight wrestler, I was 11 years old. He was trying to drown me, actually. He was so stupid. I don't know if he knew he was trying to drown me, but I was drowning, and he kept throwing me back in. So I felt like he was trying. Eventually I crawled out of the ocean so many times, he got sick of throwing me back in. And then I got home, from vacation, and my mother loved this guy, Muhammad Ali, who I always hated because he was like a dude who was bigger than everybody beat up, and he made fun of him while he beat him up. And I was like, wow, that's what all these teenagers do to me. So I don't like boxing. Well, on the undercard, my mom's like, hey, why don't you watch this boxing with me? Muhammad Ali's a great man. I was like, yeah, okay. I get to watch this guy beat me up in effigy again. And then on the undercard, there's this guy, Roberto Duran, the lightweight champion, fighting some dude that's never been knocked out. And he goes out there, and it's a 17-second knockout. He hits him with a shovel hook to the liver. And they ask him, Roberto about how he felt about the guy being carried out on a stretcher to the hospital. And he said in Spanish, you know, next time he goes to the morgue. I was like, you know what? Uncle Fred wouldn't take Roberto Duran's matchbox cars from him. So I think I want to be a boxer. and my boxing coach was this old Irish pug, and he pretty much let me know I was never going to be able to be a pro boxer because I didn't have the athletic ability, but I did my best.
It's still learning how to fight.
Take punches became a religion. What's that?
Learning how to fight's a good thing, regardless. I mean, learning how to box and all that, even if it's not going to be a career. So.
Yeah, I never lost bare knuckle fights. I've never lost any of the 7 bare knuckle fights I had. 3 draws and 4 wins.
So
for my purpose, it helped me out a lot.
Well, Well, so let me ask you, speaking of boxing, what are some boxing movies that really speak to you from your experience or just in general or just that you like as movies, you know?
Well, I'm afraid to say this one is the first one that comes to mind because I haven't seen it since I was a kid. So the boxing choreography is probably going to be almost as terrible as the Rocky movies. And that's The Great White Hope with James Earl Jones about the life of Jack Johnson. And it's just because I like the story and I like Jack Johnson so much. Jack Johnson is my favorite heavyweight boxer of all time. But I think the most accurate boxing movie in terms of the way the boxing was executed, the way you would use boxing to defend yourself without going to prison, and the way boxers are managed is Cinderella Man.
Oh, interesting.
The boxing matches are they're the best choreographed boxing matches I've seen. There's a scene where his friend tries to punch him, and all he does is step and check and turn and just make sure he didn't get hit, put the guy off balance. And this is what any boxing coach would say. What? Some knucklehead tries to hit you. Just let him know he could have been hit and, you know, don't let him hit you and just end it, you know, because there's no winning this fight. Okay, now your fight's now in a different place. You can't fight down here anymore. And that's one thing that I learned from it. You know, my boxing coach was disturbed by the fact that I wanted to be able to fight on the street. And that's one of the reasons why he didn't take me seriously, and he used me for a punching bag. That was probably good for me. I mean, the kid that beat me up was a better kid than me, so, you know, it was probably good all the way around. But the choreography in the boxing was very well done. The guy that they got to play Max Baer, I mean, he fought like Max Baer fought. And the James J. Braddock was done realistically. The bout with John Henry Lewis, that was well done. The bout with where Max Baer almost kills Primo Carnera in the ring, that was realistically done. Whoever they had choreographing that, they really knew their stuff. And then the other boxing movie I really liked, it was very accurate, and the boxing was not choreographed, which was really cool, was the movie about Mickey Ward starring Christian Bale was the older brother of Mickey Ward, and Mark Wahlberg is the fighter. Yeah, and they just went in there. Mickey Ward just like, just put him in the ring. I'm box, you know. It's going to suck, but it's going to be real, you know? I mean, it was cool. You know, like what I saw. Those are about two boxing movies right there.
One of the things about The Fighter that cracked me up was when I first saw it, I mean, I didn't know anything about Mickey Ward or his brother or anything like that. And I remember watching it and going, okay, you know, this acting is really showy. You know, like it's fun, but, you know, it's very over the top. And then you see the credits sequence and you go, oh, no, that's how it really was. You see them together and you go, oh, no, it's totally realistic.
You know, there's some real people. I mean, it was ridiculous. It was really cool. So those are both movies that I've seen twice, boxing movies that I've seen twice. So I would watch them even once again. My third favorite boxing movie, which is, you know, maybe would squeeze out The Fighter, which is, it's called Chuck. It's about Chuck Wettner.
Okay.
It's a wonderful movie. It's really well done. The guy's a liquor salesman, selling oral cocaine on the side, and he's a journeyman fighter. He was the inspiration for the Rocky movies. He was called the Bleeder of Bayonne, New Jersey. Sonny Liston once knocked one of his eyebrows into the crowd. Okay, and in fact, Sonny Liston's last fight was beating his shit out of Chuck Wettner, and as much as a savage as Liston was, he looked at the referee and asked him to stop it because he was getting sick of hitting this guy. So Chuck Wettner was like just a real character. And that was a wonderful movie. I'd have to say it's number two and The Fighter's number three.
Okay. Nice.
Yeah. No, and he covered the relationship with Stallone and all.
I always like getting the sort of boxing movie, you know, lowdown from people who, you know, have been in the ring. You know, it's good to see what movies they like and which ones speak to them.
Yeah, I remember Hagler was interviewed about which was the most about the one Rocky movie where the most ridiculous one where they had Dolph Lundgren in it.
Yeah, Rocky IV. Yeah.
Right. And he said, well, that's the most realistic boxing movie. And I immediately knew what he meant. I was like, yeah, because none of these guys can box, so the big scary guy would kill somebody. What's going to happen?
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, you take it with a grain of salt. So I'm looking forward to maybe another like good boxing movie coming down the line someday in the future. And it's only going to happen probably if it's low budget.
We
and it's
seem
not
to
a bad
get,
champion.
We seem to get like a boxing movie maybe like annually or you know maybe every 2 years. Lately it's just been like the continuation of Rocky with the Creed movies, but you'll get like a Southpaw or something, but you know, the quality of them is very varied.
I couldn't bring myself to watch any of those movies.
Yeah, no, I couldn't, but, I didn't, you know, I saw Creed.
I mean,
I
after the Rocky,
I mean, it just kind of,
after four, like, I couldn't watch any.
Yeah. I saw four when I was very young. So I saw it at a very impressionable age. So to me, it was like, it was awesome.
I remember kind of liking the one with Mr. T in it.
Oh yeah, totally.
Just
fun.
Because I liked the scene with Hulk Hogan with the wrestler.
Thunderlips.
Yeah, so Thunderlips. I was like, oh, that's cool. That, you know, that's cool. Yeah, I thought that was funny. I thought it was like funny cinema. I kind of like would always look away during the boxing scene.
Now, James, was it that spoofing the Chuck Wepner Andre the Giant exhibition bout?
Yes.
Right.
And they also cover that in the movie Chuck.
Okay. Cool.
The Andre the Giant battle, and Chuck Wepner even fought a polar bear.
Oh gosh.
He would do anything. He did some of it for charity too.
Yeah.
You know, he's still walking around New Jersey with his wife, you know. scary dude.
I mean, yeah, it had to be. You know, I don't think anybody would call him a wuss or anything to his face. Jesus.
He knocked down Ali.
Right.
He actually got Ali to fight. Ali destroyed with most people.
Right.
And, I mean, Ali beat his ass. I mean, it was brutal. I was like, wow. He, like, actually turned Muhammad Ali into a fighter for 3 minutes. That was fantastic, you know?
What did you think of the Ali movie with Will Smith, the Michael Mann film?
You know what? I liked it as a movie, and the boxing choreography was not bad. It doesn't, you know, I didn't think it was good. It wasn't good enough to impress me. No part of it impressed me, but it has nothing to do with the fact that I was like drunk out of my mind when I watched it. and then fell asleep on top of the chick that I watched it with and woke up drooling as she pushed me onto the floor. It has nothing to do with any of that. But I remember liking it as a movie. I think it washed with a lot of the biographies I read, like Ghost of Manila and the treatment of Joe Frazier, who was played by James Toney, I think for an Ali worship pick, I think was tastefully done.
Right.
You know, because Ali shit all over Joe Frazier. And Joe Frazier not only gave him money when he was banned from boxing, but actually insisted on putting his title on the line against Muhammad Ali when the ruling bodies didn't want a sanction. And then Ali, who was a mixed race man, starts making guerrilla jokes about Joe Frazier, whose family, Joe Frazier comes from a family from the Deep South.
Yes, sharecroppers.
That lived in the canebrakes, who were, some of their people were free were just like people that took the machete and said, and told the owners, just say, yeah, you know what? No. No, come get it. we're going to be doing our own thing over here. Come get it. Okay?
Yeah, I'd heard that Frasier's dad was a sharecropper or something like that.
Yeah, but further back, before that, his people actually ran away and lived as Maroons and had their own like tribal society and fought back against the slave owners and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Where Ali came from the house staff in Kentucky, which was a border state.
Right.
And the two, Kentucky and Maryland, the border states were notorious for the owners having sex with their female help and then selling the mixed race children.
Mm-hmm.
They were notorious for that. So you got a mixed race man.
They got to keep their slaves in the Civil War, too, for when they sided with the North.
That was Grant had a real problem in the department, he ran, which included Kentucky and Tennessee, with people still trading slaves under his nose. So Ali comes from the house staff, mixed race people, who, in many situations lived as members of the family. And Frasier comes from, like, three black people who fought for their freedom. And then Ali comes out as the black power guy, and he's making fun of Joe Frasier and calling him a gorilla. And that really hurt. I mean, Frasier was bitter to the end. I mean, he actually said he hoped that he contributed to Ali's brain damage.
Oh, wow.
And they had been friends. Right? You know, yeah. So that hurt. That really hurt him. And because he was keeping racial solidarity in his eyes. And then Ali turned on him and made him look like the white man's stooge.
Yeah.
Which he was not. Frasier tried to manage himself as well as he could and actually ended up successfully running his own gym and managing his son to a title shot. Joe Frasier and Ken Norton were like my heroes when I was boxing at the YMCA and getting my face beat in. And these guys were the guys that tested Ali. You know? Yeah, so I really liked those two guys, particularly Norton.
Wow.
And they wouldn't fight each other. They were real friends, Norton right. and Frasier.
James, you're kind of reminding me of that. Boxing used to be this sport with just tremendous TV ratings. I think in the 50s, it might have been the highest rated sport on television. And I noticed in recent years,
it's the first televised sport. So.
Right. It has completely declined in the last several decades. You've got to where people can't even name the champs. And I grew up in that era of, Sugar Ray Leonard and Marvin Hagler and Duran and Aaron Pryor and all those guys. And, Gary Cooney was the big great white hope and all. And after that, it just seemed to have faded after Tyson kind of seems like he just sort of crashed and burned. What is your theory on why it's dropped in popularity? Other than obviously all the good stuff is now on pay-per-view.
Yeah. There's a real problem with the economics of boxing where you have the top boxer makes more money than all other boxers on the planet can buy.
Okay? So
that doesn't happen in any other sport. Okay. The thing that crashed boxing was TV,
right?
Which seems counterintuitive. But what happened, for instance, in a mid-sized city like Baltimore, there were seven venues in the 1920s where you could go see live boxing matches. And this formed a really deep talent pool. And this happened in every city. And you had a limited number of organizations that were taking their cut of money when the best fighters fought the best fighters. Each one of these, if Roy Jones Jr. or some guy fights for 9 belts, he's got to give $100,000 to like 9 different organizations. Okay, he's got to make $1 million just to pay the sanctioning fee for these stupid belts. But what happened when TV came? You're not going to go see James LaFon get beat up by, you know, by Joe, you know, the auto mechanic down at the local club, when you could see Joe Lewis beat the shit out of, you know, one of the Bear Brothers on TV. Right. So it takes the money out of the local clubs. So they're not putting on shows anymore. The last I checked in Baltimore, Jake Smith was putting on 2 shows a year, and the guy at Michael's 8th Avenue was putting on what? That's 3 boxing shows in Maryland, in the state of Maryland, in 1 year. You used to have that in a week. You might have 7 in a week. Right. Mm-hmm. So there's a talent. There's a lack of talent pool. There's one of the top 10 all-time knockout punchers, George K.O. Chaney. I mean, he's got over 100 knockouts, or around 100 knockouts. He never even fought for a title.
Wow.
That's how deep the talent pool was. So you were always seeing a good fight when you're seeing the top guys. And you were seeing great fights when you were seeing the local guys. So what eventually ended up happening is you started getting, like, good-looking Italian middleweights being selected as, like, dreamboat TV fighters that, like, girls would tune in to watch on TV and that kind of thing. And it started thinning the talent pool out even more. And then when the prosperity hit in the 1950s, the only people that were still pouring up the box were collectors.
Right.
You know, so that actually crashed the market even more. And then, so the TV that we remember, that was actually milking the end of a dying market.
Mm-hmm.
And now boxing is kept on life support by MMA.
Right.
Any boxing coach that's making money is doing it, training MMA fighters. A little bit of money I make coaching. It's MMA guys that pay me. The other thing is now since MMA is like turned into this hip-hop sport.
Right.
You know, with all this, like, lifestyle stuff, like, you got to have your E's from the sound and rear, jump up and on. I'm stoked to watch and want to watch box. You know, but the guy's shorter than fighting MMA because there's less brain damage in it.
Right.
Afraid of
like, it seems like MMA has kind of fallen off, kind of losing. Like, it has no MMA and it's class and shit, kind of pro wrestling nonsense. And then you watch it here, Dana White getting shoved at the press in the weigh-in, and it, like, they're rapping with each other and everything, and it looks like Jay Lawler and Terry Funk or something.
Well, I remember watching a pay-per-view MMA match a few years ago at a friend's house, and it felt like pro wrestling to me. It didn't feel like real. It felt like it was a bunch of staged, you know, fake drama. And
yeah.
It was you know, hyping people up for the match to root for this guy. And, you know, it's just, it felt fake to me. It felt like, we were putting on a show. It felt like a big, carnival thing.
Who was it who said that, MMA was just an extension of two rednecks fighting in a car park? That was you, John.
I don't know, but that's great.
I think it was actually John. I remember John saying it years ago. I was like, oh, extension of two rednecks. Yeah, it was the extension of two rednecks fighting the car
John,
park.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've actually cornered for MMA fights. And I have 3 of my guys are fighting in Philadelphia on May 11th, so I'm going to be back on the East Coast. And that's all MMA fights. There's just, with the top rung, and the guys are all decent guys. Like, we talk to the opponents and the other coaches and everything, and then the guys exchange phone numbers, and they go and they train with each other after they fight each other. And at that amateur level, it's still really an honorable thing. But at the pro level, the promoters apparently made a conscious decision to go for NFL and pro wrestling customers and bring them into MMA.
Yeah, it seemed like they were going for that show.
They made it into this.
I got a question. What boxing film just pisses you off? You just can't watch it because because the fighting in it is so unauthentic.
Rocky movies.
Really?
the Rocky movies. I don't. I gotta say, like,
it doesn't piss me off. It's just like it's. I have trouble with suspension of disbelief.
Right.
So it doesn't get me angry. I just have trouble suspending the disbelief.
Okay, I should have rephrased
it. I tried to watch Rocky IV recently. I couldn't get through it.
Oh, it's terrible. I can't stand it. It's a flag.
I mean, the Russian chick was hot. She's probably not Russian, but I liked her. Other than that, I was like, how long can I look at this chick act like a robot? I mean, it's like wanting to have sex with a cartoon. But so eventually, I've been lost interest
in her. Well, that movie is
a
cartoon.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's a 90-minute MTV music video is what it is.
It's montages with TV-level, like, Hallmark drama in between
Somebody who's watched the Hallmark Channel extensively with my Aunt Madeline as I read history books and come up for air every once in a while and look at the slowly progressing storyline, I know what you're talking about.
I read somebody mentioned that Rocky IV was actually supposedly a middle finger to Reagan, to Ronald Reagan at the time, about the whole...
No. It feels like the most Reagan movie ever.
Yeah, it doesn't sound right.
Writers are so deluded, they think that Reagan wasn't a popular president.
He absolutely was. I mean, that movie is totally a Reagan-era film, to me. I mean,
it's flag-waving, Reagan, rah-rah-rah.
Rocky wins movie. The Cold War. I mean, Rocky is Reagan in the movie.
Yeah. Wow. See, I never saw, didn't see these movies when they came out. I haven't been much of a... I liked movies when I was a little kid because I'd wait up on Friday night. My dad was a traveling salesman, and we'd have frozen pizza and watch a late-night movie together.
What did your dad sell?
Movies was like...
Curiosity.
He sold Tractor Trailer Training.
Interesting. No, I'm very interested in, like, the traveling salesman culture. I think it's very, you know, it's kind of...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's... He had an interesting life, but I went 20 years and only saw Braveheart was the only movie I saw the whole movie of, because I worked so much. So the Rocky movies, the three Rocky movies I saw pieces of, when I was working, it was when I was either coming home from work or going to work and my wife and sons would have it on. So when Rocky IV came out, I was just hoping I'd get home from work and not get killed on the way home from work and be able to have a beer and pass out before I had to get home and go to work again. You know, so I didn't watch movies for decades. I try to watch movies now when I'm near a TV to kind of do a review. But, you know, so for me, movies like nostalgia. My favorite movie is The Last Valley with Michael Caine and Omar Sharif from 1971.
Oh, interesting.
You know. Yeah. Yeah. So, like, my movie watching was me being a younger teenager watching movies from the 60s and the 70s.
It was a better era for
you know,
movies,
like TV with my dad.
Right.
You know, so, yeah.
What about... Wow.
I've tried to catch up. But my father sold chemicals. He sold encyclopedias, and he sold tractor trailer training. And he would find a way to sell something that was supported by a government program, and then he would go somewhere where nobody else would dare go to sell it. So he went to the three high-rise Baltimore housing projects to sell encyclopedias, and he would find the oldest black man from that neighborhood who he used to meet at AA meetings. He would help. He mentored black guys a lot in AA in Baltimore, and he would, through his connections, he would find like the old patriarch black guy that the young black guys would kind of respect.
Right.
And he would go into the high rise building where police would not go into these buildings. So all those sales were his, and they were all paid for by government vouchers. Okay. So that's how he made money with encyclopedia.
Wow.
Going into these places where you see on the wire where, the police actually try to get into one of these places. They don't even make it in the front door. So he used to sell there. The tractor trailer training, he sold in the Rust Belt when all the factories went under and their coal mines started to get automated.
He would have been better off selling
tractor trailer training there.
He would have been better off selling
the
chemicals to the... doesn't matter.
He sold chemicals to workplaces. And it was kind of weird when I managed a supermarket and I had a chemical salesman come by. But and he'd have all of his little literature and everything like that. You know, so they would bring you your kit of environmental friendly cleaning supplies for your store.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and hopefully, and I actually bought color-coded chemicals so that the stock clerks I hired, when I found out that their wife had filled out the application and they were illiterate and they couldn't tell one can of soup from the other, then I could then put them into the janitorial department and they would mix up ammonium bleach and die on me in a janitorial closet because I would get color-coded chemicals and put them in clear containers.
Sounds like
kind of weird.
Like Breaking Bad.
Oh, wow. Well, the other thing I was going to ask you about old boxing history, James, is what is your opinion on the Phantom Punch on Sonny Liston by Ali?
I actually watched that with Jake Smith, who was the Maryland middleweight champion, won 17 fights, real dangerous dude. Now he's the main promoter of boxing events in Baltimore. Don't let him sell you anything. Okay, okay. The dude is aptly named the Snake. That's the Snake was his fight name. But from the point of view of a guy that knows how to throw straight punches and has coached a lot of people, there's no Phantom Punch. You can see over Liston's shoulder. Ali would actually hyperpronate his straight rear hand. He had one of the best. His jabs sucked. His jabs only worked because he was taller and quicker than the guys that he fought. He'd have a real trouble with Vitaly Klitschko in a couple of modern fighters because his jab was so defective, and his left hook was largely a jerk. But he had probably the best right hand of any heavyweight in boxing history, including Rocky Marciano. And if he could hit you with his jab, he could punch entirely through your head with his rear hand. And he would hyperpronate his punches. And when you see a fighter hyperpronate a punch and bring it up short, when he does not fully extend it, so that, like, there's a picture of Ali punching Foreman. When he has extended his right arm so far, it looks like he's dislocating his shoulder.
Jeez.
And most people can't do this. Now, when he fought Liston, Liston was coming in. He was coming in low. You see the film clip from over Liston's shoulder, and Ali's punch does not reach full extension, but you can see his pectoral minor and major striate and separate. That means he hit something. Okay? It's very similar to the punch that George Foreman knocked out Michael Moore with. A short, choppy right hand, and the guy was cagey enough and had been in enough fights. He knew he was landing his punch sooner than he had planned on, and he brought it up short, and he went for the pronate early.
Did you just say somebody punched out?
And the pronate is when you turn your palm downward, and it engages your shoulder muscle and your upper chest muscle.
Did you just say somebody punched out Michael Moore?
No, the boxer.
Oh, shit, I thought it must have been Christmas.
Michael Moore.
Oh, fucking wish.
Yeah. He was trained in Charleroi, Pennsylvania, and I actually got beat up in that ring. I only hit the guy I fought one time in three rounds. I got beat up in a ring that Michael Moore trained in. He was one of the best light heavyweight champions ever. But Michael Moore was knocked out by George Foreman when Foreman was an old dude, and a lot of people thought it was a phantom punch because it was hard to see. And Moore would agree because he didn't see the punch either. The thing is, Moore could not get up from that blow, and Liston did not want to get up. Liston probably could have got up from that punch, but he didn't want any more humiliation. He knew the way it was going to go.
Right.
He just wasn't the kind of guy that could catch Ali. He's an old guy with some injuries. He's older than people thought he was. They didn't even know how old that guy was. And he didn't want to be humiliated anymore.
Right.
He killed Ali in a street fight.
Oh, sure.
It took like six cops to lock him up. And he broke one of their legs. I mean, isn't it?
Jeez.
Yeah, breaking a grown man's femur bone is not easy. I mean, he was a bad dude, but, he's the style of fighter he is. he would have crushed Tyson. Tyson wouldn't have lasted two rounds with Liston.
But I would agree with that.
He could never lay a glove on Ali.
Mm-hmm. Jeez. Well, the one thing I was going to mention is for our listeners who might remember the good old days of martial arts books by mail orders, you had some stuff published by Paladin Press. Am I right?
Yeah, sir. Three books. Yeah. And two of them got banned on June the 29th, or no, it was like June the 22nd. Two of them got banned for reasons unknown. You can still buy them used,
right?
From some kids for like $75, you know. But right. You I must, don't know how to print them and sell them.
You must have had a picture of Bruce Lee in there, and the estate must have got a hold of it.
It actually, I figured out what it was. It had to do with another type of writing that I do, and they weren't going to ban that, which is what whoever the censors were upset with, because I don't make any money off of that other type of writing. They just hit me in the pocketbook. They slapped me down. They took $75 a month out of my $325 a month, for writing something else that didn't sell.
Right.
So that's all. There's nothing offensive in those books. I even apologized in those books for quoting elderly black men using the N-word to describe their behavior.
Oh my God.
So it's very, very politically correct, and it was, the Logic of Steel was listing for up to $1,000 a copy when it went out of print.
Jesus.
And Powell and Press finally went out of business. They couldn't make enough money to reprint that book for the amount of copies that we're going to sell. They finally went out of business, and the titles came back to me, and I published them at collector prices for like $50 a piece. I was making a little bit of money because I'm selling a few of them a month. I'm making like $25 a copy. Mm-hmm. And then they nixed that like 3 months after I started publishing them. You can still get them in an omnibus volume. Lynn Lockhart put them together as the Violence Project.
Okay.
She put both volumes together. She put them on sale on Amazon, and on the cover it says "Banned by Amazon," and it's on sale at Amazon. Okay, you know, it's less than perfect censorship practices, and really, I got like $500 in donations from readers because they were so pissed off about those books being banned, and that's more money than I'd have made in 3 years on this book. So I did okay. So I gave them the hurt.
I should add, you have something like, 50 books on Amazon? Or it's a huge number of stuff to go through because you cover history and everything.
It's like 178 titles.
Okay.
But 40 of them are redundant titles. It's like the Kindle has a separate listing for some reason or something. I think mine says I've got like 148 books in print, and she's got 22 books she's working on editing, and I've got 20 books in process and I'm working on writing. So I don't even know where the number is. I can't keep track of it, but she's trying enough to do it for me. I can't count the money in my own wallet. I got to count it three times before I go to the counter at the dollar store. So I can remember. I just, whatever number repeats, I just keep it.
Right.
You know, and that's the number I got there. So she takes care of all the math.
Right. Yeah, but it's pretty awe-inspiring. I mean, it's like for anybody who says, oh, they have trouble getting published or whatever, and they look at the way you're basically self-publishing, it's quite something. It's impressive.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. I got three books published through Pound and Press. Mm-hmm. I actually sold a book in 1992, but the publisher went out of business. So I never got the sale. And the book's still unpublished, by the way. The other books, I've published myself because you can now publish your own books.
Right.
And, I haven't written more books than like old, I haven't written more words than old time authors. It's just, I'm shameless enough to publish everything, even the stuff that's questionable quality that I'm afraid to go back and reread, for fear I'm going to throw it against the wall. I publish books on subjects that are outside of, let's say, the area where I'm known as an expert.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the old days, when you only published books through publishers, they would have said, no, no, don't write any of that stuff. Only write this subject. Just keep writing this stuff. More stuff on guys stabbing guys. That's what we want, you know?
Right.
And then that's it. So the, and even with fiction, they would slot you for a certain genre. And then you know, you'd have to write 100 Westerns. You know, you'd get in trouble if you wrote a medieval romance or something. So.
Right, right.
So I'm actually allowed to publish whatever I feel like writing. So, I don't consider myself unusually prolific. I'm just unusually shameless as far as how much of my stuff I'll allow to get published. that's all.
There's something to say for that, I think. but you had mentioned on a podcast that you had found out or had been doing research that Crazy Horse was actually white.
And the picture I saw of him at this Custer Battlefield Monument, he had blue eyes and brown hair. Uh-huh. And there was a lady that wrote a book. Her last name was Sandoz. And she was a little girl when her father, I forget his name now, he used to have a trading post. And he traded with the Indians, and he knew these people. And they... part of the legend about Indians not wanting to take their picture, have their pictures taken, mm-hmm. comes from people that are mixed race people.
Right.
That their mother was maybe a white captive or something like that.
Yeah.
So he was said to have an otherworldly set of eyes and brown hair, mm-hmm. and everybody thought he was strange. And you have Quanah Parker. Quanah Parker, he took his mother's name.
Yeah. Right.
She was a blonde. You know, and he looked, he was a very dark-skinned Native American. So it's not hard to believe that, you know, some of these blondes that get kidnapped and end up, you know, liking their Indian husband more than they like the white husband that used to beat them when they got drunk, you know, that some of their kids might come out with blue eyes. Most of the white Indians are in the East. Mm-hmm. You know, the surviving artwork from the 1700s pretty much proves that mm-hmm. most of the Indian chiefs, you know, were mixed race at least.
Right.
You know, I found illustrations of all these bearded Indians that are written into this. I'm working on a book called Paleface, just about white Indians, mostly east of the Mississippi.
What about people who pretend to be Indian?
Well, there's a ton of them. Hell, I was hoping I was an Indian when I was a kid. You know, I was disappointed to find out I was just this European mutt. That was like basically generic retread white trash. You know, everybody wanted to be an Indian in America that I know.
I think so.
You know, I mean,
you could pick up a piece of trash incredibly like that was here. You know. No, I've always had a fascination with sort of the like Custer and the you know Crazy Horse and the, but I hadn't really heard about Crazy Horse's possible racial makeup. So that's interesting. I have a book I haven't read yet by Stephen Ambrose called Custer and Crazy Horse that I've been meaning to read.
Oh, okay. There's one by Utley called The Shield and the Spear about Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse.
Oh, interesting.
And Utley is a Native American who is obviously a mixed race man. When you look at him, he looks like he's about 40% Caucasian. Looks like a lot of guys I met in Wyoming. Mm-hmm. There's The Son of the Morning Star is an excellent book about Custer.
Yeah, I've got that one. I've got the audio book and the text one. Yeah. Yeah, that was one Larry McMurtry recommended in his book on Custer, said it was one of the better ones. It was made into a film too, with Gary Cole, I think.
So, I think I remember when that aired. Yeah. Okay.
Wow. You know, I actually got to see the battlefield. I went to a couple of hunting guides found out I was working on writing a western, so they invited me west, and they took me to Custer Monument.
Yeah, I've been
and
there.
These guys have been trying to teach me how to shoot, and I couldn't even make range. I'm used to looking across the street and thinking that's far away. I'd have been with dead trooper. I would have shot a single Indian. I'd have been better off wrestling with him. So I'm there trying to figure out, like, wow, how would you keep these guys off of you? Because there was too much footage for this amount of guys They had where every guy died. They had a marker
where every dude died.
Yeah,
they have a marker where everyone fell, and you can really see where they all got slaughtered. You know, where Stern and his men died, you know, you see that field up there, and you're like, oh, this is where the last stand was, where they, you know, they all just got killed. You could kind of see the trail where they kind of flee to that area of bodies, you know.
And what, I found where one poor bastard bought it away.
Right above where I'm recording, I have the Budweiser advertisement, Custer's Last Fight. Right.
Oh, wow.
Painting above me of Custer's death.
Cool. You know, it was a cool monument. The interesting thing was first the hunters, the two hunting guys, were talking to me about the ballistics and everything and how these guys didn't have a chance, okay? He said, Shane told me, he said, the Indians had better guns than they did there. These poor bastards had carbines with brass cartridges in them that used to jam. And the Indians actually had, like, Winchesters and Sharps rifles. And then there was a rancher that showed up there. And he asked the two hunters, okay, well, where did Custer and his boys come in? And he pointed it out. He said, oh, hell, he didn't have a chance. Those horses were done by the time they got down to here. And he said, this is why you got this spread pattern here. He says, these horses all fatigued at a different rate.
Oh,
and then they shot them all right there, the ones that made it to that spot. He said, they shot them and used them as breastworks. He said, you can see that's what happened. Yeah, so I didn't understand horses. And I got this guy's like, yeah, they were. It was like, you know, everybody shows up with a flat tire and a radiator boy went over in their Humvee. And and it's like a running fight in the desert. You're done. You know, so that was fascinating.
So,
can I say one thing about one of my favorite movies?
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
Partly because part of it was filmed in Baltimore, and I thought this was the best performance that I've seen of these two actors, Brad Pitt and Bruce Willis, 12 Monkeys.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
It's got some of the few realistic violence scenes I've seen in movies in it.
I thought you were going to say,
Bruce Willis beats the guy with a phone in his motel room in Philadelphia.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I thought there was some realistic violence in it.
I thought you were going to say John Waters' early films, like Pink Flamingos.
Yeah, the way they depicted the guys in the, the orderlies in the asylum, like dragging a guy off and subduing him, that was very realistic. Mm. They actually they must have talked to somebody that did that for a living.
Oh yeah, they probably had all sorts of good technical advisors for that stuff. I know that I think Chuck Jeffries is a martial arts guy, did the choreography and stunt work stuff for 12 Monkeys. He played one of the rapist muggers that attempted to attack Marlon Stowe in that film.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. That's a good scene.
Yeah,
I like the forearm to the balls. That was good. That was good.
I think he did all the choreography for that stuff. So it's he's done a number of action movies. But yeah, because I'm kind of recalling. I haven't seen it since I saw it in the theater many years ago, but I remember liking it quite a bit.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. Okay. One of my favorite.
Let me get that in there.
Yeah. What's your opinion? Have you seen the movie Marathon Man?
No, I remember seeing a scene in it when I was lacing up my work boots, and my in-laws and my wife were watching it, like back in the early 80s, and then I went off to work.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think there's some Nazi guy pulling Dustin Hoffman's teeth. I think that's
right. He's like drilling the teeth. There's a fight scene in the film between Roy Scheider and a Korean American actor playing an assassin that I think is actually extremely realistic for that type of fight scene in a spy movie. You know, they're fighting.
Okay.
But it's sharp and it's sloppy, but it's a pretty cool fight scene. You can see it on YouTube, probably.
Okay, there's a movie that was a TV movie. The most realistic fight I've seen on film that was choreographed. It's about a female race car driver.
Uh-huh.
Her manager is a man that's a little bit overweight, and she has like an 18-year-old son.
Okay.
And they get into an argument by a pickup truck, and the man beats the shit out of the female race car driver and her son in a running fight, in a fight that goes on for a little while. It was like really the only realistic violence I've seen in movies. I mean, some of the stuff like in 12 Monkeys came close, But right, like, yeah, it just looked like the kind of stuff I interviewed people about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're just wrapping
Jeez.
Up now.
I wonder if that's the Bonnie Bedelia racing.
Heart Like a Wheel. That's what it is. Yeah.
Heart Like a Wheel. I wonder if it's that, which I think was a theatrical release, but I'd have to double back and take a look.
I think I saw it in the 80s. I think I saw it in the 80s.
Mm-hmm. That's when it came out.
I saw that, you know. I kind of knew what. My wife's like, hey, you know, this lady races cars. And I was like, yeah, her husband's beating her up.
Hey dudes, I hate to cut this short, but Stu's power is about to get cut.
Okay.
So I think we better wrap this up. But real quick, James, where can people find your stuff? Because, I mean, if you've been listening to this episode, you know James is an interesting guy. He's written a lot of great books. Where's a fast stop for them to check out your stuff?
You can go to the James LaFon blog spot. I have another website. I have other websites, but at the James LaFon blog spot, it's got all the podcasts that I've done with my editor, who's a very genteel lady. And,
yeah, it's James LaFond, LaFond dot, you know.
Yes.
And
Lynn Lockhart, and she does the Crackpot podcast. She records it with,
nice.
Calls me up on the
and,
right. I want to say thanks to Lynn Lockhart because she hooked up this, she arranged this interview for me to contact James. So big shout out to her.
For the record,
she's largely saved me from myself. At least for the time being.
Just for the record, before we finish up, I'm getting my power cut because I've got workmen here. I do pay my bills. Thank you.
It's for like legit things that Stu's getting his power cut. It's not because he's not paying his bills. That's a good. Wouldn't have thought to point that out.
Yeah.
James, thank you so much for coming on. And also, if you look up James LaFond on Amazon, you'll find a ton of books. Like he said, there's a lot of stuff on there, and you know, lots of great titles like When Your Food. Take Me to Your Breeder. Breeder's Digest is one that I thought was really good. You know, there's so many great titles. Like, if you go and look up James's books, you'll have a hard time figuring out which one you want to get first, because they all have hilarious, like, little, you know, Lesser Angels of Our Nature, Den of the Ender. You know, just so many things you go, oh, I want to read that, you know.
Yeah.
So you go look at his stuff, you're going to have a hard time picking one. Black and Pale, Taboo You, The Streets Have Eyes. You know, just that's a good
thank
stuff.
Thank you, man.
Supposedly,
the best thing I wrote was Reverend Chandler. That's the only thing I have all this. Reverend Chandler.
So that's the book you recommend people start with?
If they want fiction, if they want nonfiction, they should start with When Your Food.
Yeah, When Your Food. That's my favorite title, When Your Food.
All right. Okay. I've got another title for you, When Your Electrician Stares at You because he wants to cut.
Oh, yeah. That's Australia. It's a totally different world.
Yeah. All right, guys. Well, let's go ahead and
wrap up.
Thanks.
And we will go ahead and say adios.
I'll say see you later, MAGA.
Thank you so much.
All right.
James, for coming on. We appreciate
it. Thank you. Great show.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.